Since language helps to define human communities, why not study the history of the world through language? With me now is linguist Nicholas Osler, the author of the new book called Empires of the Word, published by HarperCollins. He's also currently the chair of the Foundation for Endangered Languages, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much.
How much can we learn about an individual community by studying the language that it speaks?
Well, I think the language is the key to the history of that community. After all, a language is what holds a community together. It enables them to communicate with each other, to take common action, and also to remind each other of what they've been through in the past. So, effectively, by learning the country's language, you learn their self-image. You will learn what they think about themselves.
And the words that they employ and the words that they don't employ are clues as well, aren't they?
Yes, I guess they can be.
Do you think that English speakers understand the world differently because of the nature of their language than, let's say, Japanese speakers? Their language is structured so differently.
Well, that's very true. And there certainly does seem to be something about being a Japanese speaker which makes it pretty hard to learn English. Strangely, it doesn't seem to be quite so hard in the opposite direction. But certainly, the most obvious example of something like that is the word for blue-green in Japanese, which is aoi and is used for traffic signals, and could be blue and could be green. So in the Japanese highway code, the lights are blue. But it is the case that languages give you a different view on the world. It's often rather difficult to articulate what that difference is. Sometimes linguists have speculated. Benjamin Lee Whorf noticed that the Hopi didn't have many words to distinguish different tenses and consequently thought that their attitude to time must be different. It didn't stop them making plans, of course.
The Israeli writer David Grossman wrote a book in which he talked about how Hebrew, modern-day Hebrew and ancient Hebrew doesn't have the ing in it, and so there was this no sense of transition from here to there. I don't know if I'm making any sense here. Like becoming, and without that, becoming, the transition becomes a real problem for people to grasp.
Yes, I guess that's right. If one thinks vulgarly, I guess, of Genesis and let there be light, and there was light. It didn't gradually get dawning.
Right. There was no
the
dawning.
The lights were on.
Do you think is it fair to say that language has actively shaped human history, or is it the other way around, that human history has shaped the evolution of language?
I would be inclined to say to go for the latter, really. But languages obviously define who you can understand easily, which group you are actually in. The German Chancellor Bismarck was asked notably in the late 19th century when he was still in power, what was the most notable fact about current history? And he said, North America speaks English. And how right he was, because, of course, the history of the 20th century is of wars devastating his country. Conceivably, if Bismarck had still been in charge, there wouldn't have been the First and the Second World Wars. And of course, they were resolved by the fact that the English-speaking power in the New World came in on the side of the English-speaking power in the Old World.
And so it was inevitable with the consciousness that the United States would become a dominant country, that English would become the key language. At that point, it was French, wasn't it?
I think, the key moment I identified in my book was the Treaty of Versailles, which was the first international treaty, which was not just in French, but it was actually had two texts in French and in English. And ironically, this was done in Versailles, one of the major cities of France. But in fact, France and indeed French had been on a downward incline for most of the preceding 100 years. All the exciting new technical developments, and there were some pretty exciting technical developments in the 19th century, had been made in English-speaking countries. Not just the United States, of course. The British Empire had quite a lot to do with it.
And how much of the importance of a language is based on commerce, in the case of the United States at that time, or colonialism, as in the case of the Brits?
Well, you do find that trade languages can characterize particular nations who wish to specialize in this sort of thing. But what I have noticed is that looking at trade languages, it's not particularly significant for the long-term future of a language. People have got a lot of money, people will do business with you, and your language will, for a time, spread through that channel. I mean, but if you look at the Phoenicians in the ancient world in the Mediterranean, they were marvelous traders. They were known for luxury goods, peacocks, cedars of Lebanon, etc., etc., all up and down the Mediterranean. But unfortunately, their cultural contributions didn't lead to any long-term survival. Every alphabet in the world, from Ireland through to Southeast Asia, derives from the alphabet that the Phoenicians passed on first to the Greeks and then the Etruscans and the Romans. But there is not a single word of Phoenician literature left. And that's not only one case. I mean, you consider the great traders along the Silk Road in the first millennium AD. Those are the Sogdians. Sogdian is a lovely word. Not many people know straight off where those people flourished. They were great traders, but now, despite all their wealth during that period, there's only one village in Tajikistan where they speak Yagnobi, which is the surviving trace of that language. Otherwise, it was left completely becalmed when trade started going by sea rather than overland.
So we can say that that colonial power and related things like the spread of Islam through the conquering of lands actually and is the really more important determinant as to how a language survives.
Well, it's very good, Lenny, that you use the word colonial, because it is important that that power should be exercised colonially, and by colonially I mean in the Roman sense. Coloni are tillers of the land. They are farmers. If a colonial power sends out settlers who speak their language, it's quite likely that the language will spread. And that's what happened when the Romans took over Western Europe, and crucially, that's what happened in North America when the British colonists set up farms here and had large families, and the next generation set up more farms and had more large families, and they got more and more. The French didn't do that, and that was crucial to the fact that the language of North America is now English and not French.
But, of course, the French grew out of Latin. The interesting thing about Latin as it was spread throughout Europe was that it broke up into different vernacular languages, from Romanian to Portuguese, and that hasn't happened with English.
Well, it's early days yet, I guess. Latin had already been around for probably about the same period that English has been around now, when it started breaking up into those different languages. But that was a political fact. It was no longer a call for all imperial communiques to be issued and for people to keep traveling around the old empire, because it had broken up into separate political units and people stopped traveling effectively.
My guest is Nicholas, am I pronouncing it wrong? Osler or Osler?
I usually say Osler, but don't worry about it.
Nicholas Osler, his book, Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Once in a while, we have the opportunity to create a language, and that's what happened with Hebrew when it was modernized after Israel became a state in 1948. Now, it had survived simply through religious writings.
Yes, I talk about the shield of faith, and there are a number of languages, particularly coming from the Mideast, which have survived far better than one would have expected as a result of their associations with particular religions. Hebrew is one such language. Aramaic is another, which spread out all the way across Eurasia as far as Peking and Mongolia and down into India, always taking the Aramaic language with it. Other languages that have flourished in that way. The most notable probably is Arabic. But Arabic had its own political reasons for surviving as well. But you could also look at Pali and Sanskrit in India, which are associated with Hinduism and Buddhism. And those languages have a language put on them. It's very interesting, in fact, that in the revitalization of Hebrew, which has been achieved in the second half of the 20th century in Israel, the zealots for that have typically not been the Orthodox Jews who are in Israel. They want to go on speaking Yiddish or something else. It's the secular Jews who decided that Hebrew should have a new life as a secular language. And, of course, this is a very interesting innovation and has been the inspiration for a lot of other languages more recently, languages like Maori in New Zealand, Welsh in Wales, where people say, look, a language can come back, and let's see if we can make it happen.
But more often than not, what we see is people working in two languages. You'll have Navajo, which is an ancient language, and then Navajos speak English when they need to talk about certain things that they can't speak about in their language.
Yeah, well, indeed, that's the great blessing of human languages, that actually more is more. You can have more languages, and you don't have to give up the languages that you already know. So there's an infinite wealth of human diversity which is available to you, which is only limited by your energy to keep on learning the languages.
Let's go back to Arabic for a moment, because that was spread throughout a large part of the world. We could say for religious reasons, but we also could say by people who were conquering other lands. Was it also a colonial impulse, or was it strictly a desire to convert people to the word?
It's very interesting, actually, that early surge of Arab, aggression, which enabled them to bring under their control two empires, effectively. That's to say, all of the existing Persian Empire, or Parthian Empire, to be more specific, at the time, which took them all the way out to Afghanistan, and at the same time to take out the eastern provinces of the Byzantine Empire. They were able to do this because of a lot of there was a lot of weakness at the time. It was a particularly good moment to strike. You can look at it because the two empires had just there before fought each other to a standstill about 5 or 6 years before this great aggression. And anyway, they found that they could take over. They found they had this faith which appealed widely, especially to the underclasses, because it's a very egalitarian religion. And as the generations wore on, in even two generations, they had taken this faith all the way to the Pyrenees in the north of Spain before they began to be rolled back again.
And then through sub-Saharan Africa.
And indeed, it spread through sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the interesting thing is, from the linguistic point of view, you cannot have Islam without Arabic. The prayers have to take place in Arabic, and that has happened. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the common people will come to speak the language. That only happened in the areas where they were already speaking what was relatively closely related languages, such as Aramaic or ultimately Egyptian.
Although in places like Morocco and Algeria, they speak a form of Arabic, but I've been told by people from that country that when they talk to someone from Egypt or Saudi Arabia, an awful lot of figuring out has to take place.
Yes, that is absolutely right. It's clear they were already speaking Berber languages, which may be distantly related to Arabic, but have not been together with them for thousands of years. But there had already been Semitic languages much more closely related to Arabic spoken in that part of the world. Punic, the language of Carthage and the Carthaginians, was nothing other than Phoenician. And Phoenician is the closest language in the world to Hebrew. And Hebrew is pretty close to Arabic, too. So you could see there was a certain leg up that Arabic could get in that area.
How much does language affect a sense of identity? In a country like Cameroon, where former French and British colonies were merged, the political struggle, as far as I understand it, has always been between the Francophones and the Anglophones. It's been less tribal than it has been linguistic.
Yeah, that's an interesting... I wouldn't claim to be any sort of authority on the situation in Cameroon, but languages do give identities, there's no doubt about it. In fact, when you think about it, the only possible reason for speaking one language rather than another is because you want to assume one identity rather than another. And so if you have two competing large powers associated with different languages in one community, it's quite likely that there will be at least friendly rivalry and maybe unfriendly rivalry. But there are parts of the world where, in fact, the same rivalry, so Vanuatu in the Pacific, is another colony which is jointly or was jointly administered by Anglophone Australians and Francophone Frenchmen. It also prides itself on being the most multilingual island in the world, per unit of area or something like that, because New Guinea runs it pretty close.
In Canada, of course, we have the French Canadians who resist being swamped by English. There again, language becomes a form of identity.
Yes,
because not everybody is originally from French stock, even though they speak French.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's an ironical situation in Canada, because it's almost as if when Britain was deprived of its own colonies by the 13 colonies' own citizens, rebellious citizens, they decided, oh, well, in that case, we'll have the French colony instead. And they went up north. And, of course, because they were so much more populous than the French, as I mentioned, because of the farming difference, they were already a large minority when they moved up in the first instance. They soon, certainly within two or three generations, became the majority in what had been a French colony.
But you have to wonder whether, if the French and Indian Wars had turned out differently, that Bismarck might not have said, well, everybody's going to speak French because everybody in North America speaks French.
Yeah, well, in that case, it wouldn't make much difference in the outcome of the First World War, because I guess the North Americans would have come in on the same side.
Nicholas Osler's book is called Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, published by HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Nicholas Osler, whose book is Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, published by HarperCollins. Latin Americans all speak Spanish. In that case, the language was imposed on people, and some of the older languages have resisted and survived. But on the whole, it was policy of the colonial power to wipe out those old languages.
Yes, it was a policy of the colonial power, which was resisted very stoutly by the Catholic Church for 200 years. The Catholic Church, who provided the first missionary linguists and descriptive linguists of the New World, and were intellectually extremely redoubtable, poured a lot of cold water on the first requests, rather tentative requests, from the Spanish monarchy that they should attempt to spread Spanish.
Why did the church resist it? Wasn't it in its best interest?
No, they just felt it was impractical. They said, look at these Portuguese, they can't even speak Spanish properly, so how can you expect these people? They've got a perfectly good language of their own. It's very elegant, they said, and indeed it was. And they were writing the first grammars and dictionaries of it. It was actually in the middle of a literary revival at the time, so that Mexican authors were coming along who were trying to equal the historical merits of Livy, and Peruvian authors were trying to equal Sophocles in their tragedies. And so, in fact, at the time, it didn't seem particularly beneficial to try and use Spanish. It was only the Spanish main power who wanted that. The priests actually felt that Latin, if it would be the best Western language for these people to learn, because it was purer, it was associated with far higher concepts, and you didn't get the stuff you pick up on the street in Spanish.
And yet, throughout most of Latin America, Spanish is the language. We see little pockets of Nahuatl and Mayan and the language in Peru?
Quechua.
But on the whole, everybody speaks either Spanish or Portuguese. So it was a success in a way that it's quite different from what happened with the British and the French, who brought their languages to their colonies, but allowed for some kind of bilingualism in them.
Yes, I mean, obviously there are a lot of differences between Spanish policy and the English and French policies, at least if you compare them over the long term. The reason that the Spanish ultimately spread their language in Latin America has a lot to do with the Enlightenment and the feeling that, in fact, the church had only a limited role in the development of civilization, and certainly if you wanted to exploit things efficiently, you should use modern methods, which typically meant using modern languages. The Archbishop of Mexico was particularly vocal in his unwillingness to learn Nahuatl and to be forced to preach in somebody else's language. But in the case of the French and the Spanish, you have a lot to look at. I mean, they spread in different ways. The French tried to spread their language faster than it was spreading naturally by sending out filles à marier, that's to say, nubile girls from the best orphanages in Paris, to go and start nice French-speaking families with the adventurous young men who were going out to become coureurs de bois and to have adventures all over North America. That worked to some extent, but as we've mentioned, they didn't produce enough big families to resist ultimately the Anglo-Saxon menace coming from the south. In the case of the English, they never did very much about it at all, other than encourage people to go out and multiply effectively, and while they were multiplying, to farm, go and get more land. Land is what they wanted, and land is what they found, and they didn't mind how they got it. They might claim they were going to pay for it, but if necessary, they would take it at the barrel end of a gun. So English spread by what I call sweep aside in North America. That's to say, the English-speaking communities grew and grew, you could almost say in a cancerous way. Other people were coming in, of course. Immigrants were coming in who would not, after something like 1780, 1790, the balance of immigrants began to be people who weren't speaking English. Nevertheless, by that time, the colony was clearly an English-speaking place. And Germans or Russians or Poles or Chinese or whoever came in would feel that they had to learn English, and English was established.
Well, but what happened is that the educated people wound up speaking the language of the colonizer, and everyone else still spoke the old language in most of these places. Ousmane Sembène, wonderful Senegalese filmmaker, told me that when he started making films in Senegal, he made them in French. And then one day when he was showing them in a village to people he was trying to reach, the guy said, well, why didn't you make it in our language, Wolof, so we could understand it? And so he started making films in indigenous languages. But that's rare. More often, the artists of countries like India, even Malaysia, wind up writing in English because that's the language of the educated people.
Yes, I think that's right. And we might see a change, though. Obviously, the big audiences for books and films tend to be the educated people. But of course, as soon as I said films, you can see that it isn't going to be only the educated people. More and more people from the villages realize what's on offer and will be demanding things. Something very analogous happened at the time of the spread of printed books in Europe in the 15th, 16th centuries. Until that time, learned discourse had been exclusively in Latin, of course, because there were just a few educated people and they could hold forth in this language, which you had to learn through a lot of repetition when you were young. What they discovered with the advent of selling printed books was, first, that people wanted to read in their own language, particularly they wanted to read the scripture. But once they discovered that, they found that actually they could sell books and make a profit on selling all sorts of books in different vernacular languages. And this completely undercut the intellectual advantage that Latin until that time had had. So I think we're in a dynamic situation. It's quite likely that in future The dominance of these colonial languages, which you're talking about, English, French, Spanish or whatever, may actually be diminished.
But we see a situation in China where the Chinese government is trying to get everyone to speak Mandarin as the national language, and people in the different areas are resisting, almost treating it as though it's a colonial language being imposed on them.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of what's going on in China. Everybody in China learns to read and write Mandarin and to understand it spoken as part of their education system, and they do have a universal education system in China, so it's pretty fair bet that everybody in China is competent in Mandarin. It's true that there are other Chinese dialects and other languages unrelated to Chinese which are still spoken in China and will continue to be spoken in China. And it's also true that at least for this generation, the Chinese government are putting an unprecedented effort into teaching their population English in schools. It's interesting to see whether that will happen in the next generation as well, when the Chinese begin to feel that they are more dominant in the world's markets.
So there is a lot of resistance to the imposition. I understand from Chinese people that those dialects hold on, and I was wondering why some languages hold on when others disappear. After all, you are the chair of the Foundation for Endangered Languages, so you must have thought about why some languages resist being eliminated despite the power of a dominant language, and others just disappear.
Yes, it's crucially a matter of morale, I think. Attachment to your language is about being attached to certain aspects of your own different identity. And when you're happy to let that go, it's quite likely you'll be ready to let your language go as well. But so what you're talking about is perhaps vociferous tendencies within the Chinese state, which may be of interest and which we and our children may yet see effects.
There are people who are predicting that sometime in the not-so-far future, Chinese will take over as the language, the lingua franca. English will go the way of France in the last century.
Yes, I think that's pretty likely, not only because there are already three times as many native speakers of Chinese as there are of English, but not only because Chinese economic clout is growing exponentially at the moment, but also because of certain technical developments which we can expect to come to fruition in our generation, really. I'm talking about things like machine translation, automatic interpreting of various sorts, which will make it possible for people to speak effectively any arbitrary language and reach people who don't know that language at all. These technical means are at the moment enabling us to broadcast our voices. I think they're going to enable us to transform them quite soon.
But doesn't Chinese present a special problem in that it's written with calligraphy, picture writing, as opposed to being written with an alphabet that is more easily understood universally?
Well, this would have been a problem if we were having this interview in the 1970s, but all those technical problems have now been solved. It's perfectly easy to send Chinese through the internet. It's easy to type in it. All the things that you need to do in Chinese or Japanese or Thai or indeed cuneiform, you can do without much ado.
I understand you've learned 18 languages. Are you fluent in all of them?
No, certainly not.
But in the ones that you are fluent, do you find yourself becoming a different person when you're no longer translating but just speaking that language because the language has a unique quality to it?
Yes, it's got something to do with one's desired persona, hasn't it? I mean, certainly one does feel one's self a little bit more courteous, a little more generally outgoingly genial if one is talking Japanese than if one's talking English. But there's something of the same feeling which comes over you as an Englishman coming to the United States. You know, you hear all these people using American accents for real, not just for entertainment purposes, as it seems to us. And then, of course, we have our own role within this. This is going to happen between languages, I guess, as different characters perhaps will be associated a little bit with different languages. But I found, you see, I was a graduate student in the United States for 4 years in the 1970s. I had not the slightest tendency to give up my British pronunciation, and indeed my British way of expressing myself, because, of course, I was reaping benefits from it, from the attitudes that with which it was met by all these nice Americans that I talked. But what I noticed, well, after I'd spent 2.5 years in Japan, for the first time when I came to America, I found myself beginning to speak in an American accent. It's just that I had somehow inured myself to putting on the persona of the foreign country in which I'd been in, and it applied just as much in the USA as it did in Japan.
During the years of the Soviet Union, Russian was imposed on a lot of different countries. Is Russian in decline now with the fall and the breakup of the Soviet Union?
It seems to be, yes. Evidently, a large number of the distinct territories which were taken over by the Tsarist regime in the middle and late 19th century, particularly in Central Asia, but also, of course, on the border between Russia and the other European countries, are aggressively dropping the background in Russian, which they have had in their school systems, which you might have thought they would see as a good basis for their contacts with the wider world. I mean, you're seeing people taking up English in Lithuania and Latvia, which has absolutely no background in England, in English. And indeed, of course, the same thing is happening in Central Asia, where, of course, the US power is beginning to meddle far, far away from its traditional spheres of influence.
In a country like the former Yugoslavia, we see a situation where a language that was created to unify people is now breaking up again. So we no longer have Serbo-Croatian, we have Serbian, we have Croatian, and all of the other languages of the area, Macedonia separate, Slovenian separate. It's like, although they're endangered languages, there are also languages that are redeveloping.
Yes. I mean, a lot of that is where it leads to a conflict between one's position as an objective linguist as to what actually the language is like and how the speakers see it as being different. The Serbs and the Croats would like to have different languages. Unfortunately, from that point of view, they actually have the same one.
Written with different alphabets.
Yes, written with different alphabets, but it's totally. And apparently the dialect areas cross-cut that is the difference between Serbs and Croats, so it's quite interesting from that point of view. But you find similar situations like that in other parts of the world. In India, for example, Hindi and Urdu are called different languages, but again, they are mutually comprehensible. They are written in different alphabets, and one it tends to be associated with Muslims, and the other tends to be associated with Hindus.
In India, with partition, you had Bengal split into two parts, mm-hmm. but it really was pretty much the same culture, and the same thing happened with the Punjab.
That's
so the
right.
Languages are, the people speak the same language, even though they have been divided purely on religious grounds.
Yes, that's right. But they wish their languages to be different. And it's quite likely that if the situation continues, their languages will become different.
Nicholas Oestler, Oestler, his book Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, is published by HarperCollins. Any last thoughts? Chinese, you say, or Mandarin will be the language of the future. Any other languages coming along to challenge it?
Well, Arabic is coming up nice and fast. So is Spanish. But that's a matter of birth rates more than anything else.
And in the United States, there are many people who are upset by the fact that there are so many Spanish speakers.
Yes, indeed there are. I've had some experience of it myself with a Californian shock jock. But I wouldn't be too optimistic necessarily about the prospects for Chinese, at least in the longer term. We're talking centuries here, because Chinese has allowed its ancestral culture to be westernized. It's given up on its ancestral monarchy.
And we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. Tomorrow, Bo Diddley will be here. The rock and roll legend's distinctive rhythms changed music history. Also, we'll hear about the new film, The Warrior, and take a look back at the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers. And on our weekly feature, Please Explain, it's all about Scientology, which has been in the news a lot lately. We'll find out what it is and what it means to be a Scientologist. We had help on today's show from Elizabeth May and Ben Yakis. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. See you tomorrow.